The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Yeah. So with Buddhism's emphasis on seeing things as they are, having this clarity, having insight, and it would seem that with this wanting to be with things as they actually are, and that's such a big part of practice, is help us to, you know, contact and touch and be with what's actually happening, as opposed to our reactions to what's happening, or just being lost in fantasy, or being lost in the past or the future. So with all that, it might be a little bit surprising to see that actually imagination has a role in practice. It has a vital role. It's an important role. And so it's something that I wanted to explore a little bit today. And I'm influenced by Gil, those of you who don't know, the founder of the center here. He and I have been talking about this, and he recently wrote a short essay talking about imagination, and it just got me thinking about this. So for the our spiritual practice, our meditation practice, imagination can be actually a powerful tool. And if we consider that it's imagination is a creative power, a creative quality, a faculty, a capacity that all of us have, this ability to visualize or somehow bring to mind something that's not obvious or is not yet apparent or doesn't exist for others. But imagination really allows us to open to new ideas, allows new ideas to be created, to be explored, to be expressed. And an obvious example is the gardener who imagines how, you know, these plants are going to look like when they grow up or when they are flowering. But my mom recently did some gardening, and I was looking at these little plants like, really? Is that, are these going to be like closer together in a few years, or what's going to happen here? They're so far apart. And I was asking her, and how big is this going to get? It seemed like so tidy and stuff. So, but you know, people who know gardening, of course, you have to use your imagination a lot to imagine like, okay, when this is bigger, it's going to look like this. Or when this is flowering, these colors will be beautiful and appropriate there. And of course, people who are artists use imagination. And even maybe planning a meal, Thanksgiving is coming up, and thinking about, okay, just imagining what would be nice for that gathering or something like this. So of course, imagination is something that we use all the time. And then of course, if our minds are not in the present moment, if we are not here with actually what's happening, with the clarity, the alignment with this actual experience that we're having, well, then what is happening? It's imagination. We're imagining about the future, either planning or fantasizing, worrying, whatever it might be, whatever our favorite things are to do. Or we are bringing to mind something that doesn't exist because it came from the past. So that's a form of imagination also. So if we're going to be imagining anyway, why not use it as a tool? Why not use it as a way to support us? Instead of fighting all the time, of like, oh, no, there can't be any movement for imagination. No, we can use this kind of, this quality, this faculty that we have as a way to support our meditation as well as our spiritual practice in general. So The way that part of imagination can be a tool is not that we imagine ourselves in a different situation. It's not the purpose of imagination in the spiritual practice here. But instead, the purpose or the way that it can support a meditation practice is to provide some inspiration. Maybe we bring to mind an aspiration we have. Maybe we bring to mind an exemplar, somebody we know about that has that inspires us and that has a practice that we would like to emulate or behaves in a way that we think is helpful and that we would like to learn from. Or we might, imagination can also be a way of settling the mind. A way that, an example could be that, maybe I'll say this also, imagination, that the Buddha used this capacity for imagination in these many colorful similes and these metaphors that are in the teachings. As a pedagogical tool, as a way to support his teaching, as a way to help things be more memorable and have a way that we can relate to it, he uses similes, metaphors, stories. And one example is, some of you may be familiar with this, with the five hindrances. These are five obstacles to feeling settled, to feeling present, to being with what's actually happening. And then after describing these five hindrances, he describes them. He wants to convey, what is it like to be free from these hindrances? What is it like when they are not present? And he describes them as being like being released from prison. That feeling of when the doors open. Maybe it feels like that sometimes when you're in an elevator and you're feeling stuck in the elevator and the doors open, that sense of relief. Or that being released from slavery, having to do something you don't want to do, not having autonomy, not having the freedom to move about, to do what you think is best, do what you want to do. There might be times when we have, hopefully none of us are slaves, but there may be times when we are in situations where it's expected that we behave a particular way, and it's feels uncomfortable and it feels like not what we want to do. What comes to mind for me, of course, is more children have this feeling where their parents are like, because I said so, you have to do X, Y, or Z. But maybe we have some form of that or a flavor of that in our lives now. So being freed from prison, freed from slavery, freed from debt. This feeling of, owing something. And when to be free from debt, that kind of lightness that happens, the maybe some delight, some exhilaration, I finished this. I had this obligation, I had this responsibility, and I satisfied it. That feeling of exhilaration, maybe. So freedom from the hindrances also, he described as being cured from an illness. So you can imagine what that feels like. We all have had this experience of not feeling well and not having enough energy. And then when the energy returns and wellness returns, that feeling of more increased energy and capacity. And of course, the last one is the simile of making it safely across the desert. Maybe there's not enough water, or maybe there's the equivalent of pirates in the desert. So in this way, the Buddha used kind of these similes, an encouragement for us to use our imagination, not only to visualize, use our cognitive capacity, But also these particular ones also have an emotional component to them. So they have these two elements, both kind of a cognitive and more of a felt sense. And it's this combination that helps kind of calm the mind, collect the mind, bringing these different aspects together and supporting one another. So not only does it help us to remember or inspire us, perhaps, the freedom of the hindrances, but also to support a certain amount of settledness, to support a certain amount of collectedness. So many of you may know that there's, if you read the suttas or if you've listened to a lot of Dharma talks, there are many, many similes. I wanted to share a few of them today. And one of them is when he's giving meditation instruction to his son. He wants his son, you know, to become established in meditation and to have a mature meditation practice so that he can achieve greater freedom and ease, awakening. So his son's name is Rahula. And he says to his son, "Rahula, meditate like water. For when you meditate like water, pleasant and unpleasant contacts will not occupy your mind. Suppose they were other people were to toss both clean and unclean things into the water, like feces, urine, spit, pus, and blood. The water isn't horrified. The water isn't repelled. The water isn't disgusted because of this. In the same way, meditate like water. And when you meditate like water, pleasant and unpleasant contacts will not occupy your mind." So he's using the idea of that some steadiness that we can have, just like water, and I said earth here because the simile that Buddha continues includes earth and water and fire and space. I think it's one of those unusual suttas that uses space as an element. But the idea, though, is that there's these steady, stable responses that are non-reactive, they aren't horrified, repelled, or disgusted. Instead, are able to just recognize, oh yeah, okay, here's some unpleasant experience that has arisen that's in my mind. The sutta uses these words, clean and unclean. We could say things that are pleasant or unpleasant as well. And to not, and to have the capacity to just simply hold it. Just like water holds it, just like earth holds it, just like air would hold them. One thing I appreciate about this simile is also acknowledging that there are unpleasant experiences, there are pleasant experiences, there's this big range of them. And he's liking some of them as feces, urine, spit, pus, and blood. Right? This isn't your usual list of things, but the Buddha's just acknowledging things that may be like this arise in the mind. Or maybe there's sense or sensations, but these are all part of our experience. And then his encouragement, can you not be reactive? Can you just be steady and hold it? So perhaps building on this simile of meditating like water is another one in which the Buddha says, we don't know to whom he's speaking. This is just a few lines out of the Dhammapada, which is a very popular, it is the most popular book of I'll say suttas. It's written in verse, and there's lots and lots of little short verses that are, some of them are really delightful. And Gil Fronstall, the founder here again, he's translated a copy of it. But this is the most translated book of all Buddhist books. So there's probably 20, 30, 40 different translations you can easily find. So here's one verse. Don't disregard good actions, thinking, oh, they won't affect me. I added that part, the oh part. With dripping drops of water, a water jug is filled. Little by little, a wise person is filled with good. Drip, 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 drip. I love this idea, right? Just these small actions that we do, right? They add up, they influence us. Sometimes it's easy to think that, you know, to be dismissive and to think, well, okay, it doesn't matter that I'm allowing myself to get all riled up about things. Or maybe it's easy to think like, well, you know, these small acts of generosity or small acts of kindness or even small short moments of mindfulness, we may be tempted to kind of dismiss them and think, yeah, but they're not the big, giant movements of grand gestures or the big Shazam moments of clarity or goodness or somehow. But with dripping drops of water, a water jug is filled. How else would it be filled? Just by putting water in. Maybe sometimes it drips faster than other times. But probably all of us have known about or have had this experience, right? With a faucet in your home doesn't, for whatever reason, begins to drip and you don't take care of it right away. And then you see when the bill comes, like, wow, all these extra gallons of water just with these little drips. Have this experience. I think those of us here in California were sensitized to this, right, with the drought. So this again kind of points to a steadiness, but also a certain amount of diligence and vigilance in the way that we practice. Here's one more simile. Don't worry, this whole talk is not only about similes. Or maybe you're hoping that it will be. Also talking about what are some of the experiences or some of the, yeah, maybe I'll use this word, some of the experiences that we can have in meditation. And this can be as something to inspire us, something that can maybe be aspirational or clarifying about what's possible. What are some of the things that, if not being experienced right now, is possible with practice? So the Buddha says, suppose there's a lotus pond with clear, sweet, cool water, smooth banks, and clean and delightful. And nearby there's a lovely forest grove. So we can just imagine some water that's, there is a certain delight that happens if you're, often if you're out for a walk or a hike, or like, oh, a pond, a lake, even with a creek. There's often a sense of happiness when we see, when we're walking along and see a little bit of water. And then this simile continues. And then along comes a person struggling in the oppressive heat, weary, thirsty and parched. If we remember that this all takes place in India, of course, right? India gets very, very hot certain times of the year. And the path that this person is on heads in one direction. It heads to that same lotus pond. And if a person saw this other person, they'd say, oh, this person is proceeding in such a way and has entered upon such a path that they will arrive at that lotus pond. And then sometime later they would see that person after they had plunged into that lotus pond, after they have bathed, after they have drunk the clean, clear water, when all their stress, their weariness, their heat exhaustion had faded away, and they emerged and sat or laid down in that lovely forest grove, and there they experienced pleasant feelings. Imagine this feeling of, maybe it's an idea of an oasis when you're feeling struggling, weary, thirsty, and parched. This idea that there are more places, that there's relief, that there can be a resting place, a place that is satisfying, that refreshing, maybe nourishing and supportive. Just like when you're really, really thirsty, parched, and you're able to have a drink of water and dip into the pool. And then the Buddha continues, in the same way, I understand for some people that this person is practicing in such a way and has entered such a path that they will realize the undefiled freedom of heart and freedom by wisdom in this very life. And having realized it with their own insight due to the ending of defilements. And then sometime later, I see that they indeed have realized the undefiled freedom of heart and freedom by wisdom in this very life. And they live having realized it with their own insight due to the ending of defilements. And they now experience pleasant feelings. So the Buddha is describing a place in practice, a stage in practice perhaps, where there's can be a resting in pleasant feelings, an ending of defilements. Where we have the undefiled freedom of heart. And where there is the freedom by wisdom, by walking along the path and having some, gaining some wisdom, gaining some understanding that corresponds to being completely refreshed, completely nourished, completely cooled, quenched. And that can serve as a support for our meditation or our spiritual practice to realize that there are places like this. Sometimes we can use the words and concepts and we don't really connect with what's happening. But maybe if we can connect to this feeling of either when we've been really hot and finally cooled down, or maybe when we've been really cold and finally been able to be cozy sitting next to a fire. The same type of experiences. Now here's one story I'd like to talk about. This kind of has an interesting beginning. This was a time when the Buddha was teaching. Maybe before I say that, I just want to emphasize it's about the imagination, like how the use of imagination can really support us. And we can draw from our own experiences and think, oh, maybe it's like this. And it's an opportunity where emotion and kind of the cognition maybe come together and really support us. So here's this story of at one time the Buddha was staying in a particular place, and then 500 monastics came to where he was. And these 500 visiting monastics were exchanging pleasantry with the resident monastics, right? So it was at a big monastery, and there's lots of people that were living there, and then all these new people showed up. They're exchanging pleasantries, and they were preparing their lodgings and putting away their bowls and their robes. And the Buddha asked his attendant, "Who are these loud and noisy people?" And the Buddha says, "One would think that they were fishermen hawking fish." Often we don't hear the Buddha talking in this way, right? He's usually having the inspiring language, but in this way, he's saying, like, what's going on? Why is it all so noisy? So, I'll say as kind of an aside, later they talked about this was really early in the Buddha's teaching career, when there weren't really a lot of rules or standards about behavior or how the monastics should behave. And this, they're saying, well, as a consequence of this, having maybe 1,000 people, all the ruckus, that maybe there was a little more emphasis on comportment and how monastics should behave. But then the Buddha asks all these monastics, "Why are you so noisy?" And then they say, "Well, we are visiting here, and we were exchanging pleasantries with the residents, and we were preparing our lodgings, and we were putting away our bowls and robes." And then others there kind of encourage the Buddha, and they say, "You know, they didn't mention this, the monastics themselves, but they are actually new monastics. These are people who had just newly ordained. And they are junior, recently ordained, newly come to this practice." And then they continue and they say to the Buddha, "If they don't get to see you, they may change and fall apart." Fall apart. Maybe we could say that as maybe not be quite as collected or be as steady. And then this person says to the Buddha, to the Buddha, if they aren't able to see you because they're new, they may change and fall apart in the same way that if young seedlings don't get water, they may change and fall apart in the same way that young calves, if they don't see their mothers, they may change and fall apart. In the same way, these monastics are junior, recently having ordained, and newly come to the teaching. So the Buddha says, okay. Presumably they've settled down a little bit. And he gives them this talk. Keeping in mind that these are new monastics, and he wants to encourage them in their practice. He wants to encourage them on having, you know, started this big endeavor, right, to ordain, to leave behind their families, to leave behind their belongings, whatever wealth they had, whatever objects they had. And then Buddha says to them, "Anyone who enters the water can anticipate 4 dangers." What 4? The dangers of waves, the dangers of crocodiles, the dangers of whirlpools and the dangers of sharks. In the same way, a person who goes forth to the, who ordains into the monastic life can anticipate four dangers: waves, crocodiles, whirlpools, and sharks. Right, so here we're trying, you know, imagine that the Buddha is asking people to use their imagination, right? Because they're in the Ganges River basin here. It's likely that many of them have not seen sharks. Maybe I'll say as an aside that different translators translate this differently. Some say fierce fish. Some say river dolphins. So it's not quite clear. Nobody quite knows what these are. So he kind of like unpacks this. So what is the danger of waves for those people who have newly gone forth? It's when a person, this expression, gone forth, that means has newly ordained, just become a monastic. When a person has gone forth from the lay life to the monastic life thinking, I'm swamped by ideas of rebirth, old age, and death. I'm swamped by sorrow, lamentation, pain, sadness, and distress. I'm swamped by suffering. I'm mired in suffering. Right? This is a person who does not have pleasant experiences. All their experiences are, you know, unsettling, uncomfortable. And this person thinks, hopefully I can find an end to this entire mass of suffering. So that's why they ordained. And then when they, after they've ordained, their spiritual companions advise and instruct them. You should go out like this and come back like that. You should look to the front like this and look to the side like that. You should move your limbs like this and extend your limbs like that. You should wear your robe like this and carry your bowls like that. These newly ordained people, like formerly, I advised and instructed others. And now these other monastics, some of them young enough to be my children or grandchildren, are advising and instructing me. Angry and upset, they reject the training and leave the monastic life. In this way, the danger of waves is a term for anger and distress. So maybe I'll ask you guys, what do you think? In what way are waves? How is that like anger and distress? Why do you think the Buddha chose to make this connection, this waves, like anger or distress?
Well, they're hard to navigate. Do you ever go into the ocean? And if you go into the ocean the wrong way, it's going to spit you out or pull you under. Or so you have to sort of bear it strategically, because if you don't, it's you just get tumbled.
Fantastic. Thank you. Anybody have some other ideas? Waves. The danger of waves. Remember, imagination is a way that we can use this to support our practice. Let's be creative. Let's come up with something. How are waves like anger and distress? Or maybe...
Okay, they can be really big waves. They can be tsunamis. They can be like that giant wave that just comes and knocks you over. It's anger can be like that.
Yeah, right? It can be overwhelming. What about this idea that maybe waves are something that we can also kind of see coming too, right? Like we can see this, often when there's anger, we can start to feel initially like some contraction or some there's some irritation that gets flamed or inflamed or something like that. So that's one way I was thinking about waves with anger and distress. Do you think, so now we'll go on to see, like, what are crocodiles? So a person has gone forth thinking, I'm swamped by ideas of rebirth, old age, and death. I'm swamped with sorrow, lamentation, pain, sadness, and despair. I'm swamped by suffering. I'm mired in suffering. Hopefully I can find an end to suffering. Right, so we get a sense of like what their experience is like, what is motivating them to want to go forth. And then after they've ordained, their spiritual companions advise and instruct them. You may eat, taste, and drink these things, but not those things. You may eat what's allowable, but not what's allowable. And you may eat at the right time, but not at the wrong time. Maybe as a little aside, I'll say this, that what wasn't allowable primarily is for animals to be killed, specifically to be fed to a monastic. Monastics would eat meat if it was offered to them, but it shouldn't have been killed specifically for them. If that's what the family was eating, and they went to that family's house for alms rounds, and the family shared their meal with the monastic, then they would eat meat, but they weren't allowed to encourage the family members to kill animals. So their spiritual companions are advising and instructing them on what to eat, what not to eat, and when to eat. And angry and upset, they reject the training. Oh, sorry. Then they, after having been advised by their spiritual companions, they think, when I was a lay person, I used to eat, taste, and drink what I wanted. When I was a layperson, I did not eat, taste, and drink what I didn't want. I ate and drank both allowable and unallowable things, and I ate and drank at the right time and at the wrong time. I should say also, what is the wrong time? For monastics, they don't eat after the noon hour, so they eat in the mornings only. And that was primarily because they're going on alms rounds, and it's so that they're not all day long knocking on people's doors with alms rounds. It was to make that simpler for their relationships with the laity. So angry and upset, they reject the training and return to a lay life. So the danger of crocodiles is a term for overindulgence is said here. So in what ways are crocodiles like overindulgence?
Well, I imagine they eat whenever they get the opportunity.
That's right.
And they eat whatever presents itself.
That's right. And also, okay, so I have, what are some other things about crocodiles? Thank you, Lewis.
Thanks. Whatever their prey, they swallow it whole.
Not only that, Rachel, when I imagine crocodiles with these, I haven't seen one in decades, but they just have these huge mouths. And when I looked on Wikipedia, like, okay, crocodile versus alligator, one thing that's different about crocodiles is that when their mouths are closed, you can still see their teeth. Their teeth are on the outside, so they just are really, scary looking, and they just come up and... just eat something, right? So how is this relevant to one's spiritual practice? How is being a, we could say overindulgence, but also how might having a fear of crocodiles, you know, does this support our practice? Can we turn this into a modern, relevant, contemporary simile? Remember this idea about imagination. Do you have an idea, Lewis?
Well, I'm afraid I only imagine that the example of the crocodile is scary enough that it puts one off of the idea of doing exactly as one pleases.
Yeah. Right, that maybe we don't know, maybe at that time people were getting eaten by crocodiles. Like maybe they even like knew people. Those of us that live here in California, crocodiles aren't a part of our regular experience. At least I don't think it is. Not part of my experience, I'll say that. So now whirlpools. Then what is the danger of whirlpools when a person has gone forth thinking, I'm swamped by ideas of rebirth, old age, and death. I'm swamped by sorrow, lamentation, pain, sadness, and distress. I'm swamped by suffering. I'm mired in suffering. Hopefully I can find an end to this entire mass of suffering. Then when they've gone forth, they dress in the morning, they take their alms bowl and their robe, they enter a village and town and go on alms rounds without guarding their body, speech, and mind, without establishing mindfulness, without restraining the sense faculties being eye, ears, nose, mouth, and touch. And on their alms rounds, they see a householder or a householder's child. A householder is a non-monastic person. They see a householder entertaining themselves with the five kinds of sensual stimulation. So that means, you know, something that's stimulating for the eyes. Maybe they're, well, I was thinking of a contemporary thing would be like with our phones, right? We're stimulating our eyes and maybe sometimes with sounds and maybe touch the satisfying things. So they see this somebody who's not a monastic, you know, maybe a similar idea of doing what they want to do, entertaining themselves, amusing themselves with whatever's amusing, toys, games, dancing. And the monastic thinks, formerly, when I was a layperson, I entertained myself with all five kinds of sensual stimulation, so all five senses. And my family is wealthy. I can enjoy wealth. Why don't I reject this training and return to the lay life so I can enjoy my wealth? And so they do. And so danger of whirlpools is the term for the five kinds of sensual stimulation. Do you have some ideas? In what way are whirlpools like entertaining, amusing, sense stimulation, something like this?
Well, I certainly can get stuck in the vortex. It's sometimes it'll be, you know, the internet vortex, the obvious thing. We look one thing up and it's like 2 hours later. Yeah. And you've followed this chain of wonder, you know, to not necessarily any great, you know, end. You can do the same thing with anything. Anything sense-based or mind-based that you just get stuck in a loop.
Yeah.
It's those things are seductive in and of themselves.
Yeah.
And they don't go anyplace except in a big tight circle.
That's right. They don't go anyplace. And they kind of ripples kind of like suck you in, right? They kind of pull you in, that kind of feeling. Yeah, I think that probably all of us have this experience with the internet at least once. Anybody else have some ideas about that? Why the whirlpool might be?
Well, I suppose also, I mean, you were hinting at this, that when you are on the periphery of the whirlpool, it's a gentle, kind of seductive thing. One doesn't realize the strength of it until one is immersed.
Yeah, yeah. So maybe we could bring in that other simile about drop by drop, jug is filled. So, right, in the same way, maybe on the periphery of the whirlpool, just we're on the periphery enough, it fills up a jug full of wanting more sense desire or something, like sense pleasures or something else. So Mark has a comment here.
I recall an experiment that was done once, not too long ago, where they had some college students, they just had them sit in the room and be quiet, you know. And if they couldn't take it anymore, they would give themselves a shock, you know. You know, they, and it turned out, I don't remember the exact percent, but especially the men, it was like about 3/4. And it wasn't a minor shock. I mean, it actually hurt.
Wow. You know?
I mean, this was, what that brings to mind is the idea that the whirlpool is so ubiquitous that it's invisible. In other words, that's the norm. Mm. And then when you take it away, you get outside of it, and you're calm. Some people just don't know how to deal with it.
Yeah.
So this idea that it's, maybe it's not quite fits in there, but it sort of brought this to mind. So anyway.
Yeah, no, it's good, right? How it has this power to pull us in.
Without even.
And then when we're not pulled in, we maybe are disoriented. Maybe we're used to spinning around, around, around.
Well, you don't even see it anymore. It's like, ask the fish, how's the water? You know, and the fish will say, well, what's water, right?
Yeah.
So.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you. Okay, so here we are now with sharks. And what is the danger of sharks? It's when a person has gone forth from the lay life to homelessness thinking, I'm swamped by ideas of rebirth, old age, and death. I'm swamped by sorrow, lamentation, pain, sadness, and distress. I'm swamped by suffering, mired in suffering. Hopefully I can find an end to this entire mass of suffering. And when they've gone forth, they dress in the morning, and taking their bowl and robe, their alms bowl and robe, they enter the village or town for alms. Without guarding body, speech, and mind, without establishing mindfulness, without restraining the sense faculties, there they see a person scantily clad with revealing clothes. Lust infects their mind. So they reject the training and return to the lay life. So danger of sharks is a term for lust in the mind. What do you think about this?
Sounds fishy to me.
That was funny. That's very cute. I think that there's a number of, first off, I'll say there's a number of things about this little passage on sharks that the way it's written a little bit differently than the other passages, so it suggests that it was tacked on. And we know that this is true, actually, well, because the first three of waves, crocodiles, and whirlpools, we see those in a number of different suttas, but the fourth, where there's the sharks, we don't see that all the time. So it feels like there's reason to believe that this got stuck in later as a way to... But at the same time, we can imagine if you have this something that, well, I think celibacy is not easy. Let's just say that. It's not easy. And I think probably for all monastics and all religious traditions, you know, this is something that they have to work with. And sharks are scary. And so maybe this idea of losing your celibacy, if this is a vow that you've made, is something that, I don't know, the Buddha wanted to, you know, he's talking to brand new monastics and saying, these are the things to look out for. These are the things to take care of. And the one thing that's, for me, I'll say, was interesting is that they... Here he's describing somebody who's gone in to do alms rounds without mindfulness, without kind of some restraint of their faculties. So what's implied here is that you might see a scantily clad person with revealing clothes, but you have some mindfulness, and you might just be able to see, oh, here's a little bit of desire arising, and then letting the desire go away. And it's not a problem. It's just a part of the human experience. But it's when we aren't really aware, we don't have our mindfulness with us, we don't have our restraint of our sense faculties. Restrained in the sense, unrestrained means that we're out there looking, or trying to hear things that are going to be satisfying. So in this way, we can see how the Buddha used imagination, primarily in the way of using similes. But it's also an encouragement for us, like how can we use our imagination to use a way to inspire us, to support us, not to get lost in fantasy, but to help bring some juiciness, some fun, some liveliness to our practice. And I see that we have about 1 or 2 minutes for our comments. Not a lot of time, but if somebody wants to make a comment, question. Andrew has a comment if we can.
This is kind of cheeky, but I mean, I find this story quite kind of bizarre.
Yes, I do too.
I mean, let's remember, it started with the 500 visiting monastics, and which, you know, created this uproar, which the Buddha reacted to. And interestingly, I guess the Buddha, rather than like just being calm about it and chill, you know, he was clearly upset and annoyed, and and then it was impressed upon him that I guess effectively he needed to teach these people, otherwise, you know, the consequences, they might leave the monastic life. And and I, as I understood it, the teachings were these similes, as you refer to them. And as the newbies entering the monastic life and providing this story to them. And I mean, I'm sure there's some traditional reason why these similes were used. I noticed that they all had to do with water.
Yeah.
Water as a force and animals in water. So I don't know what that means. There didn't seem to be any clear relationship between the simile and the thing that it was representing, except that all four similes were something that engulfed or swallowed or, you know.
Yeah.
But anyway, just kind of bizarre. And then that's how it ends, and whatever happens to the 500 monks or the 1,000 monks, we never really have any sense.
Maybe I'll say two things about this. The tradition has a lot to say about this. Like, what? Was the Buddha really annoyed? But Buddhas don't get annoyed, so what really happened there? And I chose it because it's a little bit bizarre, because I thought it was fun and a little bit... I wanted to bring in something a little more playful. And I liked what you said about these four things that are things that engulf waves, crocodiles, whirlpools, and sharks. They kind of like engulf. And in the same way, things engulf us and can bring us away from our practice. Thank you, Andrew. Okay. I wish you all a wonderful evening. I don't want to take you too late. Bye. Yes.